May it please the Court, my name is Michael Wells and I'm appearing this morning along with co-counsel Ann Cartwright on behalf of plaintiff appellant cross-appellee Robert Snipes. In this Title VII retaliation case, the district court abused its discretion by improperly excluding relevant evidence detailing the disparate treatment of other employees who shared the same performance characteristics, qualifications.
What significance did the exclusion decision have? District judge, this is a bench trial.
Correct.
The district judge excludes the evidence because, in his view, it wasn't going to be persuasive because it concerned employees dealt with by a different supervisor.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So what the judge is telling you is that had he admitted the evidence, he would have found it unpersuasive because it was dealt with decisions by a different supervisor. And since the judge is the trier of fact, in this case, the exclusion decision is functionally identical to the decision on the merits.
Well, Your Honor, I'd respectfully disagree with that conclusion. By excluding the evidence, Mr. Snipes was unable to present a prima facie indirect case of retaliation at trial because he was unable to establish the third prima facie element, that being the causal link between the statutorily protected expression and the adverse action. And we believe that the district court, in the record, does not make clear that consideration of the evidence after admitted it would have ruled the same way because the district court instead chose to exclude the evidence summarily before considering it fully. Mr. Snipes, a correctional officer, was terminated after filing at least 8 complaints of racism with the Illinois Department of Corrections while serving at its racially charged Pontiac Correctional Center. Despite its policy to fully investigate and, if necessary, refer all complaints of racism to the Internal Affairs Division, the department made only one formal investigation into one of Mr. Snipes' complaints of racism. At the same time, the department seized an opportunity to strictly apply the terms of its affirmative attendance policy in disciplining Mr. Snipes and terminating his employment. The department's policy, this objective disciplinary policy, provided for 9 steps of systematic progressive discipline in the discipline of unauthorized absences. Pursuant to the policy, no less than 5 supervisors were involved in the discipline of each unauthorized absence. In Mr. Snipes' case, those decision makers applied the policy strictly, culminating in Mr. Snipes' termination from the department in September 1991. In fact, the department's only reason offered for termination of Mr. Snipes was violation of the attendance policy. Meanwhile, the department granted leniency under the policy to at least 11 other non-complaining officers who shared the same job position as Mr. Snipes, who were employed by the department during the same time period as Mr. Snipes, who were disciplined under the same exact policy as Mr. Snipes, and finally, and most importantly, had as bad, if not worse, attendance records than Mr. Snipes. At trial, Mr. Snipes offered the evidence regarding these 11 non-complaining officers, but as stated earlier, the district court summarily excluded the evidence without fully considering it.
The district court's rationale was that these were decisions by different supervisors. Is that correct?
That was the only stated reason the district court gave.
That's correct. Factually.
That is correct, factually. 3 points, however, show that the district court's rationale in excluding the evidence constituted an abuse of discretion, the first being that claims of retaliation indeed can be proved indirectly through circumstantial evidence, the second being that Mr. Snipes and the proposed comparators were indeed similarly situated as to be comparable, and the third being that a blanket exclusion of comparators' evidence based on the fact that the comparators and the plaintiff share different supervisors constitutes an unreasonable restraint on indirect claims of retaliation. And in response to your question, I'll move first to the second point of my analysis, that being that Mr. Snipes and the proposed comparators were indeed similarly situated. In defining the requirement of similar situation, this court has been guarded in the fact that the requirement has been stated as not to be construed narrowly. Indeed, there is no magic formula in determining whether or not 2 employees are similarly situated. Most generally, this court's decision in Radue v. Kimberly-Clark Corporation stated that most of the time, employees to be similarly situated must be similarly situated with respect to performance, qualifications, and conduct. However, while Radue does acknowledge that differences in supervisors most generally will prevent 2 employees from being similarly situated, the court does stop short of making this an absolute factor. In fact, an employee need not show complete identity between themselves and the better treated employee, but rather must only make the same general comparison. And this is where the district court's analysis was flawed. The district court provided only one rationale for excluding the evidence, that being a difference in supervisors. However, this case is distinguishable
from... But apparently the supervisors had different attitudes, so wouldn't that put it in the core of the rule as to why you don't compare across supervisors?
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, respectfully, that the differences in supervisors' policies is merely a veiled attempt by the department to cover for its illegal retaliation that it took with respect to Mr. Snipes.
No, what's the evidence of the veil?
Well, the policy remained the same, Your Honor, under both Wardens Peters
yeah,
and
but
Graham.
They have discretion and they administer it differently. So what
some supervisors are lazy and never try to crack down, and other supervisors are extremely hard-nosed and inflexible Captain Queeg types, and that doesn't have anything to do with discrimination in violation of federal law. In order to show retaliation or to show discriminatory treatment, what you need to show is that the same supervisor confronted with equally bad attendance by somebody else did nothing. But apparently you haven't offered that kind of evidence.
Well, we would argue, Your Honor, that the policy and the discipline under the policy remain constant under
no,
both boards
see,
and supervisors.
It's very common. You have a lax supervisor, and then he's replaced, and the new supervisor decides to show he's not lax.
Well, I do agree with you, and I do understand the need to be able to improve upon sloppy administration. However, Mr. Snipes was never notified that the exact same policy providing for strict guidelines and discipline would be changed.
But that has nothing to do with discrimination.
Changed.
I mean, that's just, you know, you may have gotten accustomed to a lax regime, and then the new guy comes along and tough, makes an example of you. That may be unfair, lack of notice and so on, but it has nothing to do with discrimination.
But respectfully, Your Honor, that the only problem with that analysis is that Mr. Snipes was the only employee at the Pontiac Correctional Center who complained of racism. And that places him in a class in and of himself. And that's where the comparison is made, and that's where the inference can be drawn that there is a link between these complaints and his strict discipline, as opposed to merely just a change in supervisors. And that would be the argument that we would offer in opposition to the department's argument that the difference in supervisors was dispositive. In this case, we have a centralized hearing process, and an unauthorized discipline absence comes forward through the shift supervisor, and then is referred to the major, the assistant warden, the warden, there's a hearing officer involved, a union representative, back to the warden, and finally, with termination, it heads to Springfield, Illinois, for the deputy director down in Springfield of the prison system. And we would argue that this process distinguishes it from RDU in cases like RDU, holding that different supervisors are dispositive, because the policy and the discipline itself never changed. Under the policy, the first absence would be awarded an oral reprimand, the second a written reprimand.
But when we review discretionary judgments by district judges, we give them a certain deference, so you can have opposite results and they're both affirmed.
That is correct, Your Honor. Under an abuse of discretion, we must show that this error affected the essential fairness of the trial. But by not...
No. I'm talking about the discretion exercised by different supervisors. They're subject to review, but that doesn't mean that the reviewer within the prison system is going to make a de novo determination. He's going to defer, to some extent, to the supervisor's judgment.
That is true. There is a certain amount of... a degree of discretion determining whether to refer the absence. But in disciplining the absence, theoretically, the policy provides for the exact discipline that should be awarded for each unauthorized absence. And that's wherein we would argue that the differences in supervisors is negated. It's not necessarily with the referral of the absence or the decision whether or not to affirm the discipline under the absence.
Now also, these people you want to compare them with, didn't they accrue their absences over a longer period of time?
That is true, Your Honor. There was a slight difference in the difference in time accrued by the absence. However, all of the absences were accrued with respect to the comparators during the time period that Mr. Snipes was employed by the department.
No, I understand that. But if someone has the same number of absences, unexcused absences, over a 2-year period and over a 1-year period, the person who accrued them in the shorter time period is the worst absentee and can be expected to be dealt with more harshly, don't you think?
Well, rationally, I agree, Your Honor. That argument does make sense. But under the policy, there was no provision that determined discipline based on the frequency of the absences, merely just the number of absences. And once a finding of guilt was made and it moved forward and that discipline was given, then the next absence, regardless of whether it occurred 2 days or 20 months apart, would still be awarded this next level of discipline. Now, with Mr. Snipes, this is true because if each the policy was applied strictly. Mr. Snipes was terminated, or actually suspended upon discharge after his 9th absence, which is warranted under the policy. However, with the comparators, in one situation with correctional officer Elman Mathis, he incurred 16 unauthorized absences. And for 10 of these absences, he was granted leniency under the policy, including a suspension where discharge would have been warranted. And that's where we draw the inference that these complaints of racism, it's not the referral, but rather just the strict discipline that the policy provides, which doesn't allow for exception. And the department's applying it one way to Mr. Snipes and another way to the comparators. I believe I'm out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Wells. Ms. Welsh?
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm here on behalf of the Department of Corrections. Your Honor, as the Court indicated, the relevance of this testimony, because it was the relevance of the discipline by a different decision maker who there was testimony was more lenient than the supervisor who disciplined the plaintiff, is just simply not relevant because it's not probative of the discriminatory animus of the supervisor here. To be relevant, evidence has to show that some tendency toward making a fact more probably true than not. And here, the fact that the plaintiff was trying to prove, was that it was more likely than not that there was a discriminatory animus on the part of the supervisor. But you can't prove that by showing that a different supervisor was more lenient than the supervisor at issue. Further,
the prison had a policy of assigning a particular supervisor to all people who had complained about discrimination, and it turned out that this supervisor who was put in charge of, mm-hmm. say, troublesome cases, mm-hmm. was really a stickler for all the mm-hmm. rules, and the result was that people who complained about discrimination got washed out mm-hmm. for noncompliance with the rules. This guy who was assigned, never had a discriminatory thought in his head. All he wanted was utter compliance with every rule. But it was not coincidental that he ended up as the supervisor. Would you, in that case, think that comparison across supervisors was appropriate?
I think that if a plaintiff were able to show that sort of evidence that the hires up, that the director chose a stickler and assigned only the troublesome cases, that might lead to an inference of discriminatory intent in such a case. But here, as the court noted, there is no such evidence. There's no evidence that there was a change in supervisors or a change in discipline.
Judge Easterbrook is just trying to spice it up for you. So.
I understand that, and I'm trying to bring it back.
Can I ask you about the cross appeal?
Yes.
Well, first, I think you violated our rules because you didn't include in your brief, maybe there's a separate appendix I haven't seen, the actual order by Judge King.
That's true, Your Honor. I did. I forgot. I immediately, I realized this right after I had
sent it. And his order, although it's brief, he does give reasons why he thinks Snipes can't afford to pay this. So
correct.
Why should we look further?
Because, Your Honor, the decision here.
I mean, your argument, as I recall, you say something about, well, maybe he'll have a windfall, inheritance, the lottery. But of course, if that's on that reasoning, there's no such thing as indigency because everybody has a chance of getting rich.
Actually, Your Honor,
in America, right? Your argument is too strong.
Well, the more important argument, Your Honor, is that this particular plaintiff owns a house, owns a car, has a salary, and certainly given his current assets, while he might
have... Judge King listed his expenses. They don't seem like frivolous expenses. I mean, probably where he lives, you don't have a car, you don't get to work. It doesn't say it's a fancy car or that his daughter has a fancy car. Maybe she can't get to school without a car. And he lists all this person's, Snipes' expenses, and they add up to a substantial amount. Doesn't even mention tax, maybe he doesn't pay income taxes, but it doesn't look as if he has a lot left over to pay the, $1,800 or so in costs.
Right. Your Honor, again,
what kind of review are we supposed to give to this?
Your Honor, it is abuse of discretion, so it is deferential, but given the facts here, in this case, remember, there's a difference, Your Honor, between access to the court. Congress was very clear in making a difference between access to the courts, the filing fee, and so on, which is waived in plaintiff's case, and the cost. There's a difference between allowing a plaintiff access to the courts to have a stay in court and to have to, nevertheless, assess the risk of being unsuccessful and having to pay costs.
Well, what is the standard you're asking us to adopt? That anyone with a salary can't get excused from paying costs?
Well, I'm saying that in this case, certainly someone who has a house, who has a salary, who could conceptually who has assets enough to take out a loan because to pay the equivalent of $1 a day over 7 years. It's not just that the plaintiff might be unable to pay, you know, $1,700,
$1,800. That's what you want him to do, pay $1 a day for each 7 years.
No, actually, what I think he could do, for example, would be to take out a home equity loan for $1,800 and pay it back to
somebody
else. And
then he'd pay interest on that, and it'd add up, and it'd be worse.
Right. Well, but again,
sticking with the $1 a day, that sounded a little more logical.
Well, I'm saying that it's the equivalent of $1 a day, and this is again
for 7 years.
For 7 years, because the judgment would last for 7 years. Again, the notion behind the cost is that the denial of cost is that there has to be an inability over the life of a judgment for the losing party to pay the cost. And here, I think that
highly improbable, not necessarily impossible, because as Judge Posner pointed out, any one of us might suddenly become rich, all except federal judges. If we got sudden, unless we'd all be indicted.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's only happened in the state courts, Your Honor.
No.
But again, a high improbability, and here
that's
I don't think
that's not true either. But that's okay. So
Martin Manton,
reassuring anyway.
fewer times in the federal courts then.
Federal courts are smaller.
True enough.
We're only 3% of the judges in the United States. 3% chances that we're going to be caught with anything as foolish as that.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow,
yes, but anyhow, this court has said, I mean, the whole idea is that you have to, you can't give a plaintiff everything to gain and nothing to lose, that you have to make a plaintiff, even an IFP plaintiff, an indigent plaintiff, assess the risks that, financial risks of losing
and dozens and dozens of cases, we finish up the opinion by saying each side to bear his own cost and let it go at that. So nobody suffered, the loser does not suffer to us. That's in the vast majority of the cases.
Right. Well, that just happened. But here we did move for cost.
I know.
We did,
they moved
right.
For court in the other ones, too. We just say, nope, each side bears his own. Great American system. Pardon.
I'm sorry. Well, the judge did make a finding that he can't afford to pay. So what have you actually given us except speculation that he really is able to pay?
Your Honor, I think that if this court holds that a plaintiff, a losing plaintiff, who owns a house, who owns cars, who has apparently enough discretionary income to pay expenses, car payment for his daughter, to hold that person doesn't have the equivalent of $1 a day over 7 years is an abuse of discretion.
Mm. Did you ask for an opportunity to depose him on this?
No, I believe he just submitted his affidavit. It would seem, because it would seem to us anyway, that the evidence of home ownership would take him outside the realm of waiver of cost.
He has a big mortgage, though. He does have a mortgage.
Yes, he does have a mortgage. Yes. But he presumably he has equity in his house. The again, Your Honor, if in other cases, even prisoners whose monthly income, admittedly with fewer costs, is only, or weekly income is $7 a week, if people like that,
they have fewer expenses.
Fewer expenses, but some, I mean, you know, inmates also have child support. Inmates also have been ordered to pay child support. Inmates also have personal costs for, you know, personal items and so on, would want to give, you know, would want to pay their daughter's car payments. Again, I think just because someone has been given IFP status, which is really what the district court seemed to think, didn't make a separate analysis about the possibility of being able to pay in the future. And again, access, having access to the court is a different concept for Congress. Congress didn't create a presumption against waiving the filing fee by the government. It did, however, create a presumption in favor of paying the cost to the losing party, to the winning party, who had to incur those costs and should not have done so. Unless the court has any further questions.
Okay, thank you, Ms.
We ask the court to affirm the judgment but reverse on the cost.
And your time has expired, Mr. Wells. Or would you like to say something about the cross appeal? Just a minute.
Take a couple seconds for the court's time.
The first point I'd like to make in response to the department's argument is that Judge Easterbrook actually hit the nail on the head by stating that if you switch supervisors... to the cross appeal. Okay, yeah. I apologize, Your Honor. Your Honor, generally we'd like to rest on our briefs with respect to the cross appeal. The district court did make a detailed analysis of Mr. Snipes' financial wherewithal, and it determined, and this is before taxes, that Mr. Snipes in the year 2000 only made $14,000. And after his expenses are taken out, again before taxes, he was only left with $5,261. For the entire year to sustain himself and his daughters, and we believe that it would be a bit draconian to require Mr. Snipes to take out a lien on his personal property or his real property in order to pay the court costs. We don't believe that the department has provided anything sufficient to overturn and meet the abuse of discretion standard, and we believe instead that we should affirm the district court's decision with respect to costs. And
okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.